Okay, I'd like to introduce Bridget Brown. Bridget Brown lectures in actuarial studies at the ANU. She joined ANU in 2011 after serving as the Life Chief Pricing Actuary at Partner Re Europe Limited. She's a fellow of the Actuaries Institute and the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries in the UK. She also worked on this paper with Chen Tang. Can't be here, unfortunately, but anyway, over to you, Bridget.
Thanks, everyone, and I hope you... I'm very interested to hear questions and get any sort of discussion going. I don't like to use the word passionate about things because I think it does get a bit overused, but I do find I'm very drawn to things about what's happening in mortality and how much it's changing. And I do have some sort of pretty pictures for you, so hopefully I can entertain you a little bit. So this was actually a joint work. It was the work of an honours student last year. That's one way that academics kind of get things done, by getting honours students to do work for us. And Aaron and I supervised Chen in this project. So, you know, projecting mortality. What do we know? Okay, well, I think if I've learnt one thing over about sort of 10 years exposure to trying to forecast mortality, is that the more I've learnt, the more I've come to understand that we really have a lot more to learn, and we have a lot to understand about this. So we do know, you know, the major theme, mortality is declining, that's, and we actually know quite a lot about why mortality is declining, or why it's changing, and the sort of age ranges and different causes of that decline over perhaps the 20th century. But, you know, there's really a lot we don't know, which means that, in particular, it's very hard for us to have anything more than a watching brief on what the future holds. So I'm going to talk to you about sort of different models and different approaches to forecasting, but I think the main thing we need to maintain in front of this challenge is a fairly high degree of humility, that we really are trying to forecast something that is, in many respects, unknowable. So sort of more active management of the risk is probably the key issue. But I still think the method I'm going to present to you today is one of many different methods that are available, and I personally find it's a method that draws on the best of what we know today without sort of overstating the case, if you like. And I wouldn't recommend necessarily directly that you adopt our basis, you know, the end result of our work. What I'd really like you to think about, if this is part of your job, is to actually think about adopting the method and going through the process yourself and using it to help you come to a view on what the basis should be for your own portfolio. So I think probably the way that we've learnt to think about the way mortality is changing is effectively to look at that rate of change, which is popularly known as mortality improvement, because mortality is basically going down. So we tend to think in terms of the rates of mortality improvement. So these are percentage rates coming from the Australian Government Actuaries report. So, you know, the positive rate is the rate at which mortality is going down. So 3% improvement, mortality is 3% lower than it was the year before for that particular age. So what I've got up here, and I don't know how easy it is to see, is the 25-year average rates in red and blue, and the 100-year rates in green and purple. So I think the key features here is the sort of more extreme levels at the 25-year, below the mean, if you like, below the 100-year mean for the younger ages, and well above the 100-year mean for the older ages. And the 100-year average is kind of like a much flatter sort of curve. I think probably the younger ages are probably actually, especially for females, influenced by things like changes in maternal mortality that probably aren't going to happen again. But apart from that, you've got a kind of a mean reversion type situation. Now, that big hump of very high rates of improvement at those sort of early older ages, sort of around the 60s, is probably the key to what woke actuaries up, if you like, to the whole issue of mortality improvement, particularly in the UK, that this was happening so fast. It was clearly impacting early retirees, and it was impacting pension fund liabilities. But it's not frozen in time. This is a bit of a moving target. And if we look at it this way, we're really only looking in two dimensions when we really need to look at the problem in three dimensions. So I'm going to show you some heat maps of mortality improvement. I don't know how familiar you will be with those, so I am going to go through it in a little bit of detail. Basically, they're looking at changes in mortality over age and time, and then the third dimension being the sort of the height or the level of that change. And it does give you this quite an at-a-glance overview of the patterns, and they really are, they're going to give a much richer sort of story of the past compared to what I just showed you from the AGA. In particular, in addition to the age and time dimensions, which are the axes of the graph, you also, in a way, when you look at it this way, you see this idea of a cohort dimension, which is a dimension, a diagonal on the graph, connected with the year of birth. And I see how much time I've got to talk about that. But in any way, this diagonal pattern is there. We're going to look specifically at the rate of change in mortality, not the rate of mortality itself. If you try and do these sorts of graphs for mortality rates themselves, you really can't see very much. But when you look at the rate of change, you see a lot more. And you really need to look at the rate of change smoothed in some way. Moving averages, doesn't really matter how simple or sophisticated your smoothing is, but you'd be surprised how volatile the rate of change is year on year, age by age, in the pure data, even at population level. So, you know, sort of a primer on heat maps. This is a heat map. Or actually, you know, if I was trying to be really academic, I could say this is a chloroplath, because I learnt that is the correct technical term for this. So here we have a chloroplath. You can also think of it, actually, a lot of people like to make the analogy with like a map of terrain, you know, with the low areas, you know, lakes are kind of low areas, and something, you know, blue can be low areas and red could be high areas, that sort of thing. So we've got calendar years across the bottom, attained age up the side. So if we were to see a period effect or a time effect in looking at rates of change in mortality, we might see something like this, where, for example, if red was low rates of change or even deterioration, negative change, perhaps, work out which one of these is the pointer, yes, perhaps this could be, you know, a pandemic or some terrible event, a war or some sort of event that actually affected people of all ages in a given time period. And so on either side, the rates of change were better. An age effect might look like this, where for some reason, for over an extended period of time, younger ages have poorer rate of change, poorer outcomes, and older ages, you know, sort of race away and their rates of mortality are dropping faster. That's not, you do see age effects, but you don't tend to see them over very extended ages, periods of time. So, for example, in the UK, which I probably know a little bit better still than Australia, but in the UK you are seeing actual mortality deterioration for younger age, male and female, principally probably driven by behavioural, you know, poor behavioural choices, if you like. And then the sort of mystery one is this cohort effect, where you see higher rates of change for people born in a given year, so higher rates of improvement, mortality decreasing faster for this generation than for the people born either before or after them. And this was actually discovered, my understanding, the first I am aware, you know, the sort of first key research into it, at least in the actuarial world, was done by a guy called Richard Willetts in the UK. in a paper called Mortality in the 21st Century, and this really awoke particularly the UK actuarial profession to this, the presence of this effect, and also the nature of the sort of the way change was emerging in the population. And actually this cohort effect has been found in many other populations, including the Australian population. And there's been a lot of debate about where it comes from. It's more evident in males than females, and there's this kind of idea that it's not actually anything inherent to do with those, that generation. It's not like in their genes, but it's rather to do with successively being in the right place in the right time. So this particular generation, born around, say, the 1930s, in the UK at least, benefited from the introduction of the NHS. Then they benefited from campaigns to reduce smoking. And then they benefited from, as they aged, they benefited from major improvements in the treatment of cardiovascular disease. So they kind of were a very lucky generation. So it's not necessarily that there's something genetically different about those people. Although there's still ongoing debate, there's connection with things like diet in early age, for example, which we're starting to understand can have longer term effects. Anyway, if we take that sort of graph and apply it to Australia, this is what we get. And actually those colours have come out better than I expected. So it's using the same pattern. Green is high rates of improvement. Red is relatively low rates. I'm actually only showing 55 to 90-year-olds and the last sort of 35 years, 1972 to 2005. And this, for example, is the cohort effect for males. So age 55 in, 1990 up to age 70-odd in 2005. So I imagine for those of you with pension fund liabilities, this increased rate of improvement is causing issues. And the question is, what do we do about taking this forward? How do we extend this picture and project those future improvements in order to produce a forecast mortality rate in order to estimate our liabilities for annuities? So there's actually an enormous body of research being undertaken, a lot of activity in trying to better model future mortality. Heather Booth, who's an Australian researcher, along with Leonie Tickle at Macquarie Uni, produced a paper a few years ago that was very helpful in terms of classifying the sorts of research that have been going on into three sort of families of models. And so the three families of models they came up with were explanatory approaches, expectation-based approaches, and extrapolation approaches. So in terms of our choices, explanation, where we try and actually fully understand the past, but also fully incorporate both endogenous and exogenous features into our forecast. So things like what's going on at individual cause of death level, how do those causes of death interact, what's going on with future medical treatments, with inputs into the health system, how might that affect future mortality rates, all those relationships. I think that, you know, that's kind of the goal, but at the moment there really are pretty significant limitations to the sort of adequacy of those models. You know, it's a huge challenge and there are people who are working on it. There are sort of variations on the approaches, but it's kind of like we shouldn't stop working towards it, but it's not really realistic at the moment. Expectation-based approaches are really more sort of based on expert judgment or opinion, where you sort of take some sort of view about getting from where we are today to some sort of long-term situation, whether that's based on a target of what you might expect life expectancy to be or a target of where you think mortality rates might fall to. And one of the major criticisms about these style of approaches is that they have historically underestimated the rate of change in mortality, the rate of change in mortality improvement. They've underestimated how fast mortality's dropped. And so that's something that is I suppose you could say people are aware of it now, and I think it's an interesting question of whether we accidentally overcorrect for some of that underestimation. And then the last sort of family is extrapolation. Extrapolation, I think we're all pretty familiar with extrapolation as actuaries. It has a fundamental underlying view that future trends will be a continuation of the past. It's sort of the claimed benefit is that it's more objective, and I think it does have definitely objectivity advantages, at least in the near term, compared to an expectation approach. It's certainly the area where probably the most research and refinement is going on in terms of trying to improve models, better understand the explanatory variables in the past, and better incorporating them into the future. There's a lot of work trying to make sure that any forecasts are coherent between genders or between countries, trying to draw on a maximum of data. But I guess my concerns about the limitations of extrapolation models is summarised by this picture, which is a picture taken from German data. So this is their past, this is their heat map. Sort of really does look more like a heat map, actually, than mine. And these are two extrapolation methods. This is an extrapolation and this is an extrapolation. These are both extrapolations. Okay. So just because it's an extrapolation doesn't mean that it's necessarily a good extrapolation. There's lots of different ways to extrapolate. Obviously, you can compare the models and the validity of the models by, you know, all sorts of tests of robustness. You can look at fit and things like that. But when you're doing things like backtesting and fitting, of course, you're only doing that on the past. So you can get a model, you know, you can get a fabulous model that fits the past very well, but the extent to which that really gives you a lot of guidance, not so much about the near-term future, but at the medium and long-term future, is probably still fairly open to question. Again, this is a bit of a personal opinion. I think what tends to happen is people massage their extrapolative models to give them the answer that seems reasonable. And I guess my feeling is we might as well be a bit more honest about it, and where we're making a judgment, we should just be very transparent about that. So use extrapolation where it can help us. Admit that we're using judgment where we just don't know. In terms of what exists for Australia at the moment, we do have quite a few choices. There is a bit of work going on here. So these are a summary of the existing projections that I'm aware of. There may well be more. So we have the sort of the AGA work. Patricia Berry did some very nice work with a couple of colleagues from Swiss Re a few years ago for the longevity conference that was here. And they actually applied a variety of models and made the point quite clearly that the key is that, you know, in choosing the model and getting very different results, actually the model risk is fairly significant. So they didn't recommend any particular basis. The ABS uses an expectation approach based on target life expectancy, and that's a fairly common approach that's been adopted by national statistical bodies. The Productivity Commission came out with a almost independently produced forecast late last year, which is a combination of extrapolation with a bit of expectation tacked on at the end. And Leonie and Heather are still active in this field, and they've just updated their extrapolative model a month or so ago. So I do think there's a health in having a diversity of models. I think it demonstrates also the level of uncertainty that we're dealing with. So just to show you what those models produce in heat map terms, I don't know if I'm being mean here, but this is what the AGA forecast looks like. So this is the past. There's that diagonal I was showing you for males. This is a bigger age range, 20 to 100. So there's those 70-year-old males in 2005 at the cusp of that. And you can kind of see the miss of using the 25-year average, because we're just getting the peak of that rate of improvement wrong. because it's just a 25-year average. So just to me, it's not very satisfactory to take that past shape and use this as the forecast. This is the Productivity Commission forecast. It sort of falls prey to a similar thing of sort of converting something that has a diagonal pattern into this horizontal. Now, that is, those are not your only choices. There are definitely extrapolative models, as I showed you, that can incorporate the idea of a cohort effect. It just hasn't been done in sort of public work in Australia by any authoritative body anyway. So the approach I'm going to present to you is, I feel, takes advantage of extrapolation, it uses it in the near future, and smoothly blends from a sort of a near-term extrapolation to a long-term expectation. And I'm certainly not going to take any credit for the development of this approach. It's actually the fruits of a very long work from the Continuous Mortality Investigation in the UK, who have been, you know, of all the actuarial bodies, in any case, worldwide, have spent the most time and resources trying to understand this. So they sort of started back in only, really, 15 years ago. I mean, that's how short our understanding has been. With the 92 Bayes series, that's when they emerged with their basis for future improvements for sort of two-dimensional tables, which were being used by life officers. And I don't know what pension fund representatives would say, but my understanding was in the UK there was a lot of resistance to using generational tables, at least initially, because it was complex administratively and from a systems point of view. As a result of the work of Richard Willetts and this mortality in the 21st century, they understood the strength of this apparent cohort effect and produced some sort of adjustments with these diagonal incorporated into them. And I think at that time they realised that they needed to understand more about the work that was going on. And they went out and looked at the research and the methods that were available. And I think the foundational sort of academic work that was done in terms of forecasting mortality improvement was done by Lee and Carter in 1992, and they kind of discovered it and applied it. And in fact, the models we were looking at there were more Lee Carter-like, if you like. And they also learnt a lot about smoothing the past using splines. But in the end, they actually found that, you know, they applied those methods and they produced this vast library of mortality projections, so they could forecast mortality under every sort of model and variant. But actually, they found this was not helpful because, you know, then people were just left with like 25 different potential models to use. So they went back to the drawing board and came up with this CMI mortality projections model, which they explicitly said is not as sophisticated as some of the alternatives that they'd looked at. It's not proposed as necessarily superior to statistical or cause-based models, but it's designed to be of widespread value and have practical applications to actuaries in their day-to-day work. So I think it's designed to be something that people can easily use, explain, understand and then explain. And it's no worse than the current alternatives, I guess, would be my assessment of it. And they've also committed to that annual update. So every year when the new national population data comes out, they update the model, they update the factors, and they give pretty extensive commentary on what's going on. So I thought, you know, I was a fan of this method, and I thought it was worthwhile applying it to Australian data to see what we would get. So that's why I got an honours student to do just that, along with Aaron. So the model is really very simple. It takes your base mortality rate, so you obviously need a starting point. It takes your initial rates of mortality improvement, where are we today? And it does explicitly decompose them into those components, so into a sort of an age period component and a cohort component, so that you've kind of got a split on that starting point. Then it says, OK, where do we think, and this is where the judgment really comes into it, where do we think long-term rates of mortality improvement might land? You know, if we think that there's potential for mean reversion, which is also open to question. You don't have to have a single rate. You can have a rate that varies by age. You can do it. There's quite a lot of flexibility in the model itself in terms of how you set up that long-term rate of improvement. And then you just have to decide and advise, you know, sort of give the model inputs on how you get from here to there. So where's the model used now? Obviously in the UK, and their most recent report says that in that their understanding is that the model is actually becoming a common currency for discussions between actuaries about future mortality improvements. It has just been adopted by both the SOA in the US and the Office of the Chief Actuary in Canada for their pension forecasts. So it is starting to gain some traction, to use another phrase. And I think that's probably is because of its accessibility on the one hand, and because it sort of seems to be, I guess you could say, not unreasonable. So here's what happens for Australia. Okay, base mortality rates, I don't think there's much to say here. We use the population because we didn't have an insurance portfolio particularly to worry about. You'd obviously use the mortality level of your own portfolio. Here's the pattern for initial rates of mortality improvement for males and females. And I suppose if I'd been clever, I would have the AGA rates instantly pop up beside that, but I wasn't that organised. But I can tell you that that hump has moved forward by about sort of 15 years. So the peak of that hump is moving because of this cohort effect, and that's what we saw in the heat map. So that's kind of like, if you like, this is the last column of that heat map of the past. Now, this idea is we now need to decompose those initial rates into a age period component and a cohort component. So I'm going to sort of show you what that looks like. So these are the elements of an age period cohort model. Very, very briefly, this is the age element. So you can see that with increasing age, this is your average mortality level over the period. So on average, you know, exactly standard mortality pattern increasing with age. So nothing mysterious there. This is kind of the time element, summarised time element, what's happening over time to all of mortality. And unsurprisingly, mortality is decreasing with time. That's what that represents. So you can see there was a bit of a blip, for example, in the 60s, where the slowdown was a little bit slower, and then this very fast drop that we're seeing. You know, and I mean, honestly, if you were forecasting that, it's very hard to know what you would do in terms of forecasting that, because obviously if you keep going down this way, we'll end up with mortality at zero. So you probably want to realistically tail that off somehow, but there's not much guidance, frankly, in that data series about what that tailing off should look like. And possibly, well, luckily, you don't really need to forecast the cohort component. This is the relative level of improvement by year of birth. So this is actually on the mortality rates. So that generation with the lowest mortality rates, highest improvement, is that generation born around the 40s. And the more recent generations have had relatively lower levels of improvement, so relatively higher mortality. So those are the three components that we're then going to use to decompose the mortality improvement rate. And then the last is this long-term improvement rates, where for the purpose of the exercise, we just chose to use basically the 100-year rates. There's a lot of discussion. There's some guidance from the CMI. There's some information in the literature. Other people have thought about what this long-term rate might be. And in particular, for example, I personally probably wouldn't have included such high rates for females, because obviously I don't think we're going to see improvements in maternal mortality again. It's very common, for example, to use something around 1% per annum across the board. And it's also quite common to taper the rate of improvement down to very low levels at the very highest ages, because we don't seem to be seeing particularly any rates of improvement sort of in the 90, 95 plus ages. But again, all these things need to be monitored, and this is actually the key assumption that the UK Institute wouldn't give any advice on. It's kind of left up to the individual actuary, which is frustrating, but it's an admission of the true state of affairs, I suppose. So putting it all together, we had this green line of our total initial improvement, and from that we pull out the cohort component. So this is lower rates of improvement. This is the earlier generation, the more recent generations, that's the older generations. So in a way, this age period component is the balancing item, that blue line, because the blue and the red needs to add back to the green. And then we need to get from the blue line basically to the purple line of the long-term rate, so kind of stretch out that current state of affairs and kind of stretch it out like a piece of string and make it more like the long-term mean. There's some factors in there about how we get from here to there. So the sort of convergence duration that the CMI recommended, which we retained, basically says the age period effects last for around 10 or 20 years before you reach the long term, whereas the cohort effects, if they truly are connected with, you know, a long-term effect on the cohort, potentially the cohort effects last a lot longer, at least, you know, for the younger cohorts, and then obviously the remaining time that they can impact the older ages is a lot shorter. The convergence pattern is also kind of a user-driven parameter. This is demonstrating the sort of levers that you have to control the pace at which you get from here to there. So one of the criticisms, and there have been certainly quite sort of vocal criticisms of the CMI method, one of the criticisms was, why should we be at the peak now? Why should it be now that rates go from their sort of 4 or 5% per annum highs? Why is it now that they turn around and start decreasing down to a 2% rate? And I think that's a completely valid point. You know, we may not be at the peak of this sort of cohort effect. And if you think you're not, then rather than using the sort of default green line where we sort of smoothly go from here to there, you can actually dial that up and say, OK, well, I actually think we've got a little bit longer to go before we reach the peak, and then we'll tail down. So that's completely within the user's control. We chose to use the default. And the end result of all of that was, this is our picture of the equivalent of what I showed you before for the AGA and the Productivity Commission. So I think it's a more satisfactory picture in terms of the forecast. This is the past going into the forecast, with of course then drifting into this long-term rate. You'll probably notice this little blip here. I think this is quite interesting. The sort of cohort effect in the Australian data is not actually completely diagonal. So this is basically the diagonal. So you probably would want to refine that a little bit, maybe just to maybe make that a little bit sort of follow the generations that it's occurring in. These are the low rates of improvement, even deterioration for the younger ages that are expected to wear off. Females, basically, very similar. Weaker, a weaker cohort effect, I suppose, in terms of absolute size, but still present for females. So what does all that turn into in terms of actual numbers like life expectancy and annuity values? So I've got the 2010 and 2050 figures from, I took them from the Australian Longevity Tsunami that the Institute put out, which used the AGA 25-year rates, Productivity Commission. Heather and Leonie were sensible enough not to put out forecasts for 2050 because I think they understand the limitations, but I always say to, especially Heather, who's a demographer, I say, well, that's all very well for you to say we can't do it, but as actuaries, we have to do it. So we can't not do it. We've got to actually put a number on our liability. So even though we can't, we still have to do something. And the figures from our model. So what's kind of, and similarly then for an annuity at 65, what's pretty reassuring in some respects is that the figures are really pretty close for 2010. So in that sense, actually, the shape issue that I showed you is not really, it's not a huge problem if you're just looking at 65-year-olds today. There's obviously a bit of a difference with using the 25-year rates because the hump of those improvements is at 65 for the AGA, whereas in our model it's probably a little bit further ahead. So you do end up with a higher rate for the AGA, although it doesn't make a huge difference in the annuity values. Where the divergence comes is in the longer-term outlook. So this is a cohort life expectancy at age for someone aged 65 in 2050, which is, you know, okay, it's a fair way away, but it's not like that far away. But the difference is really becoming quite significant. You know, you're sort of talking a 3 or 4 year difference is a huge difference in life expectancy. And it's mainly because of this sort of tapering towards a long-term rate rather than forecasting current rates indefinitely into the future. So once again, I don't want to claim to have the answer, but I think that it just goes to show that this sort of level of thinking that should be gone through in terms of coming to a view on a basis and then the eventual outworkings of that. So clearly there are the sensitivities in this model due to the choices that we're making, things like convergence, things like the choice of long-term improvement rate can make a huge difference to the end result, and that needs to be understood as well. You know, if you look at the convergence structure between using sort of like instantaneously moving to the long-term rate and taking quite a long time to move to the long-term rate, is sort of like a 10% difference in a sort of life expectancy figure, and what's that, a sort of 5% difference in an annuity value. And similarly, the long-term improvement rate, it makes quite a big difference to the 2010 cohort life expectancy between something like 20 years up to 25 years for a male age 65. And clearly that difference just gets exaggerated and extended if you go out to the 2050 cohort life expectancy. And as I said, that long-term improvement rate is clearly something that needs deep consideration. And nonetheless, I think consideration but also humility, we can't think that we're going to actually know what that is. I think, as I said at the outset, constant updating and constant monitoring is really the only way we're going to stay on top of this risk and the cost, potential cost of the risk. So actually, the real most significant criticism of the CMI model is that contrary to some of these statistical models, it's deterministic. It doesn't give you any sort of idea of a range of outputs, a range of potential outcomes, except through sensitivity testing. So personally, I've been working with another student on adding that range of outcomes so that it can be fairly compared with other models. But the question I'm interested in posing here actually is whether the Actuaries Institute or actuaries in general should be looking at, for example, should be doing something in this space. I mean, it's been quite a while since we've only just recently had a new updated base mortality table and disability table for insured lives come out, a bit over a year ago. There is no longevity table. You know, the Actuaries Institute puts out something like the longevity tsunami. They're very happy to raise awareness. We're possibly fortunate in the life insurance industry, at least, that we don't have sort of the issues of the UK pensions industry, but there are obviously large pension liabilities with lifetime liabilities out there. In addition, you know, in terms of the actuaries' public service sort of, hat that they wear, they're highlighting issues and concerns about things like sustainability of the age pension and what have you, then we really should be trying to contribute to the best available understanding of life expectancies. Whether that means providing a standard table, that's one option, providing a toolkit, more actively monitoring and communicating about mortality changes and or forecasting techniques, or, you know, nothing. I mean, that's an option as well. Those were some of the things I was interested in discussing, but I'm open to questions, queries, any comments about the method would be most welcome. Thank you.
So has anyone got a question?
I might come from a bit more of a radical perspective. Futurist called Ray Kurzweil put out a lot of projections where he believes there's going to be major discontinuances in death rates. So he talks about things like nanotechnology and actually identifying the ageing gene. So his perspective is that whilst you can project from the past, there will actually be major discontinuances in the future, which means that instead of having, say, someone 65 having a 25-year age expectancy increasing to 30, it might increase to 80 or 90.
Yep.
Now, that obviously has such massive implications for pension funds, for a whole heap of different societal impacts. I'm interested in your thoughts about what are the roles of actuaries of projecting from the past, which is an important science, an important contribution, but what is our role also about exploring some of those potential discontinuities?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting the way that you put it that way. I mean, my personal role in exploring some of those was mainly standing in front of investors and trying to explain what it meant that, you know, we could replace body parts by growing ears on mice and things like that. You know, the problem with these sorts of conversations, I think it's absolutely important that we have a full understanding of the range of views that include, you know, J. Olshansky, who say it's actually going to go backwards, versus people like Aubrey de Grey, who say we're all going to live forever. That is the range. You know, the range is basically 0 to 1, you know, in terms of mortality rates. So we need to narrow that down a little bit, and we need to inform it with all the ideas that are out there, but I think we need to sort of qualify them. So the end result of the sort of thing you're talking about should be in your distribution. What percentile it is, whether it's 99.5 or 99.8, I'm actually not sure, but that's the kind of calibration I used to like to do, where you'd get a scenario, what if we cure cancer? You know, and you just eliminate cancer as a cause of death, you ignore the complexity of the interactions, just knock it out, cut mortality rates by a third, what happens to your life expectancies? And the results can sometimes be quite surprising, and it really helps the people in front of you to say, well, that changes life expectancy from, you know, X to Y. So I think we do have a very important communication role in turning those scenarios into relative, you know, numbers that are relatively easy to understand in terms of life expectancy and financial impact, obviously, if that's what they're interested in. How that gets done outside of like a individual actuary working in their office who can't possibly stay on top of all of that. I mean, the way the CMI does it is they provide a longevity bulletin every 3 to 6 months, I think, that tries to keep people in touch with the major themes. They run conferences. They try and keep people up to date. Beyond that communication sort of liaison, I'm not sure that we would have sort of a... We're not certainly going to have a leading role in actually leading the research, but the another thing the Actuaries Institute in the UK has done is they have a conference every 2 to 3 years where they actually try and get epidemiologists, demographers, people from outside to talk about what they're seeing to raise awareness. So that sort of thing actually is pretty prevalent in the UK. I guess it's just slightly less active in Australia because of the context being a bit different.
Bridget, thank you. That was great presentation. And your comments just then around cancer actually just prompted my thinkings for now. I'm always a bit reminded in these sorts of things about the big disclaimer on investment products of past performance is no guarantee of future. And I appreciate very much how you positioned the beginning of your presentation. There's so much we don't know, because I think it's just so true here. Building on what Andrew was saying, maybe somewhere in the middle of the really out there sort of stuff, but, you know, anything could happen, I suppose. The stuff that's happening in the world right now, right today, that is real. And it's maybe the direction of the improvements that we've been seeing and those disruptive effects we've seen in cohorts and things, there could be, I think there is disruptive forces coming in the future down the track. And the big obvious one, pardon the pun, is obesity.
Yep.
And we know that 1 in 4 are obese. It's going up 10 percentage points of the population every 15 years, and that's measured by BMI. And that's been the guide that everyone's been using, thinking we've got a handle on it. But actually, when you look at waist circumference, the studies that came out late last year, it's actually half the population is obese. And you can't have half your population obese and not expect some consequences of that.
Some differences. I mean, I think that's another area where there's so much work going on in terms of what is actually the end impact on mortality, which is one thing, morbidity, which is another thing. And, I mean, certainly the flow-on effects with diabetes, and then probably how much work we need to do to improve diabetes management to anticipate not having a massive sort of adverse mortality experience from high levels of obesity.
That's a tough one, as you say. I mean, it does hit health first, and the health funds are reeling. They talk about lifestyle-related causes all the time, and then morbidity, and then, as you say, mortality. And I don't think there's such a big lag between the onset of obesity and the onset of the mortality. We just don't know. But it's got to be, I think there's a tsunami element to that somewhere in there, just given the volumes. The population size.
I think the last thing I would like, though, is that actuaries and others just throw up their hands and say it's all too hard. Because I think it would be a real tragedy if we went, well, it's so difficult, we don't know, so let's just stop offering lifetime guarantees on income. You know, that would just be like stepping away from what we can offer. I think we can still manage it, and I think it's really unfortunate if the end result is like, it's all too difficult, we're not prepared to take the risk. So I hope that's not where we end up.
Okay, I think that's if no one's got any more questions, we'll close it there. Thanks very much, Bridget, for your talk. And I've got 3 bottles of wine here for
Thanks
you.
Thanks for the questions. 3 bottles.